Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. Hong Kong has turned into a revolving door of arrests, detentions, and quick trials. But pro-democracy activists are not giving up.
If people tell you, Hong Kong is finished, the game is over, I say no, no way. We will not allow that to happen.
Also today, how worried should we be about vaccinated people transmitting the coronavirus? Scientists are studying viral loads for clues.
The amount of virus that's in the nose or the throat or the lungs.
And in Pakistan, a CIA operation used vaccination workers as cover in its mission to find Osama bin Laden. The Taliban is now playing on lingering distrust.
You know, they were essentially saying, do not trust health workers. They may be a spy, so they might want to harm your children.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you with us this first day of March. We start today in Myanmar, where the fight for democracy continues to reach troubling new levels of intensity. Security forces there are stepping up their crackdown on demonstrators. This weekend, military forces opened fire on civilian protesters. The gunfire came rapidly and continuously. At least 18 people were killed and dozens more were wounded. This is exactly what many feared at the beginning of the uprising in Myanmar, an uprising against a military coup that happened 1 month ago today. Since then, every day, hundreds of thousands of people have come out to protest in cities across Myanmar. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been in touch with protesters on the ground. He says that so far the killings have failed to scare protesters back indoors. Patrick, thanks for being here. How exactly is the army escalating its tactics?
What police and troops did yesterday in cities across the country, I mean, it was pretty appalling. Seemingly at random, they would pick out a few protesters on the streets and just aim and shoot them. And thank God for mobile phones, because some of these attacks were caught on video. And the message appears to be to the millions of people who are upset at this coup is that you might not be an organizer, you might not be the one with the megaphone, but you can still get shot. And I should add that in some of these cities, Marco, the army has deployed very hardened, experienced artillery units, guys that are used to fighting civil wars in the jungle. So while mostly protesters are facing police, there are some pretty seasoned killers mixed in there.
How is the world reacting to all of this, Patrick?
Western countries have this sort of automated script. We condemn the violence and so on. The U.S. and other countries have already sanctioned the coup leaders. President Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, did come out after this and say, okay, now the U.S. will impose further cost in coming days. And then even China, which is always Myanmar's lifeline, their envoy has said, this is absolutely not what we want to see. That's a quote. And emphasized that China does not condone this coup, even behind the scenes.
What is next, though, for both this movement and the army?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the willpower of the protesters. I mean, they're going out in the hot sun every day, upholding this general strike. Again, they're not going to work, and that gets harder the longer you do it. Money and energy run low, and it gets really hard when you think you might get shot. But after that widespread shooting yesterday, a lot of people came out again today. They were out just a few hours ago. Not just brave students, but bank workers, bureaucrats, even some police have defected in small numbers. And the people I've spoken to say, we don't feel like we have a future under totalitarian rule, so now is the time to risk it all. You see people writing their blood type on their arm in case they get shot, or trying to invent makeshift body armor, which sadly probably won't do much, but it shows that they know the cost. And then what's next for the military is, well, they can just decide to step it up even more and not just kill one, two, three people at a time, but send that infantry out and line up and fire on dozens of people like some invading army. And I say that because they have done it before in 1988 and in 2007.
One final question, Patrick. The Myanmar government has fired their ambassador to the United Nations, Cha Motun, for comments he made on Friday. Let's listen to part of what he said at the UN.
We need further strongest possible action from the international community to immediately end the military coup. to stop oppressing the innocent people, to return the state power to the people, and to restore the democracy.
What exactly happened? What's been the reaction to those, frankly, brave remarks on the UN stage?
Yeah, you can hear that Ambassador Chamotun, you can hear his voice cracking there. It's unclear what happens to him now, other than the fact that he has been fired. He was fired very quickly after that. I think what you can take away from that, Marco, is you do have senior figures in the government who were fully committed to the previous status quo, where the military and elected officials share power, and they have come out at great risk and said similar things. Even police officers, some of them high-ranking, have come out, but in small numbers. What you have not seen so far is any major defections from the military, and that's where it would count. And that's because in Myanmar, the military, the army, really is a world within its own, where officers are ideologically convinced that they are what hold the country together against these dark forces like rebels and colonial invasion and democracy zealots who are really puppets of the West. So they have their own internal ideology that's really hard to break, and it's often wildly out of sync with the everyday population.
The World's Patrick Nguyen with the latest news on the face-off between the military in Myanmar that staged a coup a month ago and pro-democracy protesters there. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
In coronavirus news today, across the globe, large-scale trials have shown the effectiveness of vaccines in preventing severe disease and deaths from COVID-19. But one big question lingers. How much can people still transmit the disease after they've been vaccinated? The World's Alana Gordon reports on why getting to the bottom of this question is so tricky and how scientists are tackling it.
In Israel, more than half of the population has now been vaccinated. Noah Dagan of Clelit Research Institute there is thrilled to see the early impact of the vaccines. Her study compared 500,000 Israelis who had been vaccinated with the Pfizer-BioNTech shots with 500,000 who had not been vaccinated.
The main result is that the vaccines work in real life as well as they did in the clinical trial. And I think that's the most important thing. For us, it was very exciting to see.
She says the vaccine prevented severe disease and deaths. But she and her colleague, Noam Barda, are cautious about the results.
We really do not want to overstate our conclusions about anything. There is so much uncertainty with issues like transmissibility.
Researchers are still trying to figure out how common it is for those who are vaccinated to get infected with COVID-19 and then transmit the virus. Dr. Anna Durbin is a vaccine researcher at Johns Hopkins University.
So it's important to try to understand what inroads we're making to really tamping down the amount of virus out there in the population so that we can get to the point where there's so little virus out there, we can actually get back to what we used to call normal.
But understanding how people who have been vaccinated may spread the virus is really hard. Lots of factors can influence this, things like people's behavior and lockdown policies. But scientists are trying workarounds. One way is to test vaccinated people a lot to track asymptomatic infections. Durbin says this has to be meticulous.
You have to sample the same people frequently enough to catch them when they have virus. And that can be difficult because you may miss it if they're, for instance, if they have virus in their nose only for 5 days.
For people who do get the vaccine and then get infected, scientists are also trying to gain clues as to how likely it is that they're actually going to spread the virus. That involves measuring the level of a person's viral load.
So that's like the amount of virus that's in the nose or the throat or the lungs.
Dr. Michael Marks is an infectious disease specialist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's been trying to understand this relationship and this idea that less virus in your nose and throat could mean less chances of passing on that infection.
And work that we did showed that the viral load of someone was strongly associated with how likely they were to pass it on. So we would anticipate that lower viral loads amongst people who do become infected despite vaccination would also have less risk of transmission.
Another way scientists are digging into this is studying households or groups of people in close contact with one another where one of those people has been vaccinated. Mark says the hope is you'd see a reduction in cases even in the non-vaccinated groups.
So most simplistically, I've been vaccinated as a healthcare worker. My wife hasn't been vaccinated. There is presumably some indirect benefit to my wife.
That is the hope, and one that scientists are now trying to confirm. Still, Marx says he isn't changing his behavior anytime soon. He's taking lots of precautions. He knows either way, there's still a chance he can get infected. For Anna Durbin, the vaccine researcher at Johns Hopkins, yes, there may always be some risk, but she says widespread vaccination is the key.
So I think once we get enough people vaccinated and we can reduce severity of disease, that will lead to reduced transmission. And eventually, I think what we'll see is only very low-level circulation of SARS-CoV-2 till it becomes much like the other coronaviruses that we have.
Meaning even if vaccinated people can still spread the virus, she's optimistic that communities won't experience this level of severe disease that has paralyzed the world. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
The first coronavirus vaccines to reach Ghana in West Africa are now making their way around the country. The vials got there through COVAX, a worldwide vaccine-sharing initiative led by the World Health Organization. COVAX was set up to help less well-off countries from falling behind on immunization efforts. Today, Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, was at the front of the line and became the world's first person to get a COVAX shot. Joining me now is Dr. Asidu Beko. He's with Ghana's Public Health Service, specializing in epidemiology and disease control. Let's just start, doctor, with who got the first shot. In Ghana, the president went first. Interestingly, in the U.S., it was a nurse who was chosen to get the first vaccine ever in this country that was not provided by COVAX, by the way. But who goes first does seem important. What was the reasoning for Ghana choosing to vaccinate the president first?
We did a survey. And we realized that there's a bit of vaccine hesitancy among the Ghanaian population. So the idea is that how do we get the Ghanaian energized? And the biggest person to get the trust of the Ghanaian is the president. So he opted that he wants to be the first person. That was the decision.
Got it. So getting the president to go first was a way to address vaccine hesitancy. So aside from President Akufo-Addo, have other people in Ghana now gotten their first doses? And just generally, who's at the top of the priority list?
Yes, if you look at our plan, we are doing what we call segmentation. So the health workers, they are the top. Then we have persons with underlying conditions. Then we have persons who are 60 years and above. And then we have the arms of government. And then you have frontline security personnel. But for today, it involved the president and the wife, and then the vice president and the wife.
Ghana got a shipment of 600,000 doses of Oxford AstraZeneca. I gather Ghana has also approved the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Are Ghanaians generally open to receiving any vaccines at this point?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at our plan, aside the COVAX facility, we are also looking at the AU platform, where we have the African Medical Supply platform. Then the private sector in Ghana is also trying to arrange about 10 million doses of vaccines. What they want to do with that arrangement is that they are providing the finance for government to provide the vaccines for the population. So there's a clear plan about we trying to vaccinate 20 million Ghanaians by the end of the year.
So 20 million vaccinations by the end of the year, that's a goal. That's out of a population of 30 million total. What do you think of the biggest hurdles are going to be that Ghana's going to face in this vaccination campaign? I mean, is it vaccine hesitancy and misinformation?
I think that main issue is going to be availability.
Availability, yeah.
The vaccine hesitancy is a challenge, but I can foresee that now that the president has actually started, we're going to get people on board. So we think that we can actually overcome the challenge of hesitancy. So our main hurdle is going to be the availability of the vaccines.
What responsibility, Dr. Beko, do you believe wealthier nations actually have in these vaccinations? Have they been doing enough and acting responsibly in terms of contributing to COVAX and improving public health in Ghana and globally?
We think that there's a lot going on, but the key issue for this vaccination drive is the availability and access to vaccines. So I think that's how we would rely on wealthier nations to support. If you want to be able to vaccinate 20 million Ghanaians, then we need to look beyond AstraZeneca. We need to be able to access Pfizer, we need to be able to access Moderna, we need to be able to access Sputnik. And that means you need to have the reasonable cold chain infrastructure.
Dr. Asidu Beko with Ghana's Public Health Service, specializing in epidemiology and disease control, speaking with us about Ghana's COVAX vaccine rollout that began today. Dr. Beko, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Just before dawn this morning in Hong Kong, hundreds of protesters lined up outside a downtown courtroom. They were hoping to get inside the building where 47 opposition activists were being arraigned. Many also chanted, "Liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our times." That slogan is now illegal under Hong Kong's controversial new national security law, a law that has stripped Hong Kong of much of its autonomy from mainland China. I spoke with Emily Lau earlier today. She's the former chairperson of the Hong Kong Democratic Party and was among the demonstrators outside the courtroom this morning.
There were many police officers there, and we tried to get in, of course, but there were, I guess, close to 1,000 people, and the courtroom is very small. And so we formed a queue. It ran around the block. The whole place was flooded with people, and many of them were dressed in black as a sign of protest. And what the prosecution wants is to lock these 47 defendants up until the end of May so that they can come back with more evidence and all that, which is so ridiculous. They haven't got a case yet, but they want to lock up the 47 people. Can you believe that?
Right. Emily Lau, what were the activists actually charged with?
Well, there are charges with offenses under the national security law, which was imposed on Hong Kong by Beijing at the end of June last year. They are charged with conspiring to subvert the state. Wow, very big offenses.
Do the courts in Hong Kong retain any independence from Beijing at this point?
It is diminishing quite fast. In the past, even though we came under Chinese rule in 1997, but for 20-odd years, I think the courts were independent and free. But now, in the last few years, there's a lot of pressure on the judges, and the Chinese officials are quite blatant about it. They would criticize the judges and attack their judgment. So now the judges, they are also subjected to tremendous pressure.
Given that demonstrations are not happening so vigorously these days, did it feel to you like there's a movement that still has momentum?
I think the Hong Kong people have not been intimidated so much that they will not come out anymore. Today, we saw them coming out. Once this COVID-19 subsides and the social distancing rules are relaxed, I think many, many will turn out. And so if people tell you, Hong Kong is finished, the game is over, I say, no, no way. We will not allow that to happen.
Many of your former colleagues and close friends are now in jail. Do you hear from them? Do you expect to see them again soon?
I hope I will see them, but I don't know about soon. The jails in Hong Kong are still very different from the jails in mainland China. If you are locked up here, you can still get to see your family members, get to see your lawyers, get to see your religious leaders. But over there, you get nothing. Under the national security law, they can take the people here and send them to mainland China. And that really would strike fear in the hearts of many people.
One last thing, Emily. President Biden, he's been in office for just over a month now. Do pro-democracy advocates in Hong Kong feel supported by him? And what concrete steps do they want his administration to take to support them?
I think if we talk about concrete things, I will be breaching the national security law, and you won't be able to talk to me again. So I think I need to be careful. But I hope the international community will voice support for Hong Kong people who are fighting for freedom, for personal safety. And we certainly hope the democratic world will do what they can to help us.
Emily Lau is the former chairperson of the Hong Kong Democratic Party. She's been speaking with us from Hong Kong. Emily, thank you very much for speaking with us again.
Thank you.
President Biden took some heat over the weekend for essentially getting stuck between a rock and a hard place. When a declassified intelligence report about the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was released last week, it concluded that the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the operation that eliminated the Washington Post columnist in 2018. President Biden was careful to leave the crown prince, or MBS as he's known, off the list of Saudis sanctioned by the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the White House did not want to rupture the relationship with Saudi Arabia, but to recalibrate it. Justin Scheck is co-author of the book Blood and Oil, Mohammed bin Salman's Ruthless Quest for Global Power. Justin, describe, if you would, the challenge that Biden faces in dealing with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
It's a difficult situation because Saudi Arabia is this longstanding ally of the U.S. And during the Trump administration, there was no effort to hold Saudi Arabia in check at all. And Mohammed bin Salman, you know, rose up as crown prince during that time and became the de facto leader of the country. And so now the Biden administration is in this position. How do you impose some sort of new relationship on someone who has really been encouraged throughout his life to act with the most brazen, decisive, and occasionally brutal way possible in order to take power? He's been rewarded for that behavior. Now the Biden administration has to figure out a way to encourage him to not act that way without blowing up the alliance and also without kind of giving him carte blanche.
Right. I mean, MBS has gained control over key parts of the Saudi government. He's essentially running Saudi Arabia. But in Biden's first exchange with Saudis since becoming president, he chose to speak with MBS's father, King Salman, rather than with MBS himself. Also last week, we should note the Crown Prince did speak with Washington, but it was with the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. So, Justin, just how tricky is this dance going to be for Biden going forward to work with Saudi Arabia?
You know, one of the things that Mohammed bin Salman did under the Trump administration was make a very big public show of how he was the one who dealt directly with Donald Trump. And in that way, he's communicating to his people and to the people in the royal family and also to the Arab world that he is the guy who is the custodian of the relationship with America. For Biden to say, no, I'm going to deal with your father and, you know, you're a secondary figure, is a way of publicly putting him in his place and making a show of how the U.S. doesn't consider him the head of state.
Game it out for us, Justin. What would have been the consequences if Biden put real sanctions on MBS as a result of this intelligence report?
One of the complications with Saudi Arabia, with any kind of question like this, is that the lines between the royal family and the government and the state are very blurry. So if you're sanctioning MBS, are you sanctioning Saudi Arabia as a country? Are you sanctioning the Al Saud family? Are you sanctioning the government bank accounts? It's not really entirely clean.
MBS, he's in his early 30s. He could possibly be king for the next 50 years. Is Biden's seeming deference to him setting up a relationship that the U.S. is going to regret later?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if deference is the right word yet. I feel like it's still too early to see. But the question now is, by being patient with him and not leveling sanctions, are you investing in a relationship that transcends administrations? Because that's sort of one of the things we haven't spoken about here, is that the Saudi-U.S. relationship was sort of a stable thing, like held by these old men in the U.S. and in Saudi Arabia for decades under the Bushes and Clinton. And under Trump and MBS, the relationship was in the hands of MBS and Jared Kushner, who were young men and all of a sudden wanted to change. And I think if the Biden administration is going to go back to something more stable that transcends the political administrations in the U.S. and is a more predictable relationship, you can see why maybe it's worth, you know, investing in not doing, you know, something more harsh right now.
Justin Scheck is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal and co-author of the book Blood and Oil, speaking with us about Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the dilemma he represents for President Biden. Justin, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
You're with the world. Hello, it's Marco. In October of last year, we set an ambitious goal of raising $100,000 for the world, the radio show, and the podcast. Before the end of 2020, we had raised over $118,000. This is an incredible feat we could have not done alone. Here are some of the people who made that possible. William Ishmael, Nay Cho, Muppet Lin, Joel Abrams, Colleen Slavin, Morteza Feyazi, Mark V. Hagerstrom, Dave Corbin, Mark Hawley, and Sean Fitzgerald. Thank you. You guys are awesome. Thanks to everybody who answered the call and for those who continue to listen in every day to the show. President Biden is hitting pause on deporting undocumented immigrants. It's allowed some people to breathe again. One man from Honduras had been living in a Missouri church for 3 years. He was finally able to leave.
It was amazing. Felt great to going out and smell the freedom, seeing the support.
That's still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Pakistan's coronavirus vaccination drive is underway with a donation of 500,000 doses from China.
China ka bhi hum shukriya ada karte hain ki unhone
That's Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan thanking the Chinese government during a nationally televised launch. Just like anywhere in the world, getting hold of vaccines is one thing. Persuading people to take them is another. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, vaccine workers in Pakistan in recent years have had large and unusual challenges.
Syed Firuz Shah is a health worker in a semi-autonomous region in northern Pakistan. And this is how he remembers his cousin, Wajid Ali Mohammed.
Besides my cousin, he was my best friend. He believes in negotiating. He believes in communication.
He says Wajid Ali was the kind of person who would strike up conversations with strangers. He would get to know everyone. He listened. Which is why he was also so good at his job. Wajid Ali was a vaccine worker in northwestern Pakistan. He was part of a nationwide campaign to eradicate polio. It's a disease that can permanently paralyze children if they're not vaccinated. Pakistan is one of only two countries in the world where the disease is endemic. Afghanistan is the other. 2 years ago, on a spring day, Shah says, Wajid Ali came face to face with a father who had repeatedly refused to get his daughter vaccinated.
He was, I think, some fear in his mind about the polio vaccination. That's why Mr. Wajid Ali tried his best to convince him.
If the father had refused again, Wajid Ali would have had to report him to health officials.
During the conversation, within 3 minutes or 2 minutes, the killer killed Mr. Wajid Ali with a pestle.
Shah says his cousin was shot twice. He died shortly after. He left behind 10-month-old twins and his wife. His killer remains on the run.
Mr. Wajid Ali sacrificed his life while he was saving the lives of the children of the nation.
Vaccine workers in Pakistan face serious threats. Since 2012, at least 100 health workers and their security guards have been killed. There are several reasons why, but misinformation is one of them. The same month that Wajid Ali was killed, angry protesters set fire to a clinic in the city of Peshawar. This was in response to fake videos that a local school teacher had made. In them, he claimed that polio vaccines made children sick. People were so outraged that health officials decided to suspend the vaccination drive. Another reason why some Pakistanis are suspicious of vaccination programs goes back to a CIA operation. Monica Martinez-Bravo is a researcher with the Center for Monetary and Financial Studies in Madrid.
So the story, one has to go back to 2011 when the CIA got a piece of information suggesting that Osama bin Laden might be hiding in a particular compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan.
During the planning phase, the CIA wanted to make sure that bin Laden was in fact in the compound. Martinez says agents enlisted the help of a Pakistani vaccine worker to get DNA samples from the kids living there.
In order to compare them to the DNA of bin Laden's sister and then figure out if the children were, you know, related to bin Laden, which would have been a telling proof that bin Laden was indeed hiding there.
The U.S. had already his sister's DNA because she died in a hospital in Boston. In 2011, a journalist for The Guardian newspaper published a story about the CIA program. Pakistanis were furious. 6 years later, Martinez conducted a study about vaccine trust in the country. She found that the Pakistani Taliban had used the CIA story as part of its anti-vaccine propaganda.
You know, they were essentially saying, do not trust health workers. They might be a spy, so they might want to harm your children.
Health experts around the world were outraged too. Deans of 12 American schools of public health sent a letter to President Obama in protest. The CIA said it will no longer use health workers as part of its operations. But experts say the damage was done. A Gallup survey in January polled about 1,000 people in Pakistan. Almost half of them said they will not get vaccinated against COVID-19.
People who work in health, or public health especially, work with the trust of the local populations. And once that trust is broken, it's very difficult and takes time to get this trust back.
Dr. Rana Javad Askar is a leading Pakistani epidemiologist.
I think all the nations should sign a charter under maybe United Nations or World Health Organization to never use health systems or health professionals for any other activity which is not related to health.
In the meantime, health workers continue to face daily threats in Pakistan. The government has enlisted the help of sports stars, actors, and religious leaders to spread the word about the importance of vaccines. But Sayed Farooz Shah, the health worker whose cousin was murdered, tells me he hopes that the government takes more steps to make sure that vaccine workers are safe. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
President Biden has said he wants to pause deportations of undocumented immigrants until the current process is reviewed. Despite this, deportations are continuing. At the same time, many immigrants are getting some relief, people like Alex Garcia from Honduras. Garcia lived in sanctuary at a church in Maplewood, Missouri for more than 3 years. Last week, he left the grounds of the old brick Christ Church. That's because Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, said he's no longer a priority for deportation. Alex Garcia joins us now. You spent this weekend, Alex, the first weekend in more than 3 years with your wife and children outside of the church. What did that feel like? Was that the first time you'd actually seen them in 3 years?
It felt great. Amazing. It just felt really good to smell the freedom, and so happy just to see the support from all the people. In fact, what it brings me to tears is seeing how many people support me and my family.
Was that the first time you'd actually seen them in 3 years?
We was just spending time inside the church.
So you had seen them a few times inside the church?
Inside the church, yeah. But outside, that was my first weekend.
So when you left the church last week, Alex, what was the first thing you did with your kids? What was the first thing you told them, and what did you do together?
The kid was so excited. So the first thing they told me, so we can go to the park? And I said yes. And they were so excited. And yeah, we went to ice cream shop and we get ice cream and went to the park. And that was amazing.
That must have been some of the best tasting ice cream ever, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Alex, what was it like actually living in the sanctuary of the church for 3.5 years? What did you do to keep yourself busy?
I just always was trying to fix and painting just to keep my mind busy, just to try to ignore my anxiety, my sad part.
What kind of things did you paint?
Paint the church, fixing cracks in the walls. Yeah, and then the church have a kitchen that they rent to catering, food trucks. I was helping them too. So that's how keep my life those 3.5 years busy.
Where in the church did you actually live? I mean, what was your accommodation like?
I was living in the basement.
Presumably you were able to kind of look out windows from time to time and see the world outside.
Yeah, that's how I was going upstairs and see from there outside. And I want to go outside, but I always have the fear that they might any moment they're going to pick me up and now I'll be able to see my family. That was my fear.
Were you watching the news, the headlines about the election and whether Trump might be reelected?
That was scary. That was scary for me because being with him, it was no chance. I was praying that Mr. President Biden win, and he did. And that was, to me, it was a relief.
You have family in Honduras. I gather you've been in touch with your mother there. You haven't seen her in a long time.
I haven't seen them by 20 or 21 years. I haven't seen my parents.
Wow. What have your conversations recently been with her like? What is she telling you?
She always give me hope. She always keep my dad in the keep that hope.
And you've spoken with your mother since you left the church last week?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's really happy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Now she's seeing it soon. I can go see her.
You will go to Honduras to visit her sometime soon?
Yeah, I hope when I get my permanent protection.
Alex, have you thought about what's next for you?
My plan in the future, get my permanent protection. I want to be a USA citizen so I can see my kid growing up. That's what I'm fighting for.
So I know you can breathe easier now. ICE says you're no longer a priority for deportation, but are all your concerns about getting deported, are they finished? Do you worry that you could still get deported?
I'm still have the fear that they can change their mind. And they decide to come pick me up, I'm still have that little fear. I'm not completely free yet.
Alex Garcia recently left Sanctuary from a church in Missouri where he lived for more than 3 years. Alex, thank you very much for speaking with us today, and thank you for talking about your experience. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
From a church in Missouri to a church in Belgium, in Brussels for more than a month now, almost 200 undocumented immigrants have been holding a protest in a church. They're calling on the Belgian government to grant them legal status. Some have been living in Belgium for nearly 20 years. But the government's migration secretary appears to be taking a hard line. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
16-year-old Mohamed Amin has been sleeping in the Beganage church in the centre of Brussels for 4 weeks now. There's no heating inside. And Amin, who's there with his mother, says it's far from comfortable.
It is way too cold and it is quite cramped when you sleep, since our place is next to the others. Like, clearly, we are neck and neck.
Amin is from Morocco. He came to Belgium with his mother 2 years ago to escape from his abusive father.
My father, the ex-husband of my mother, was taking my mother's money, hitting her, and she could not do anything about it. The neighbors couldn't help her, and my mother's family couldn't help her, since they could not accept the idea of a divorced woman in their family.
Not all the migrants sleep in the church. Some, like 19-year-old Nada, come during the day to join the protest and then return home at night. Nada, who's also from Morocco, has lived in Belgium with her mother for the past 5 years. And like Amin, she's undocumented. Not having legal status, she says, is no way to live.
You cannot do anything that you want. You cannot move. You cannot work. I want to continue my study in university, okay? But I cannot. You feel yourself like you are in a cage.
The 17th century Catholic Church has become a symbol of protest. It's been the location of three major migrant demonstrations in the past. This time, though, there's the added fear of the coronavirus. Karen Nessens is coordinator with House of Compassion, a Catholic organisation that works with the church to raise awareness of issues of injustice. She worries about the possible spread of the virus, but she says for many of the migrants, COVID is the least of their troubles.
They say that corona is such a minor thing to us, and we already feel dead inside now. So they say we cannot have corona, but we cannot continue like this either.
The issue of immigration has been a thorny one for Belgian governments. The last coalition fell in 2018 because of a disagreement over migration policy. It took 16 months to form a new government, and the current coalition is made up of no less than 7 political parties, so getting agreement on any changes to immigration law is going to be tough. The new Secretary of State for Asylum and Migration is Sami Mahdi. He's the son of an Iraqi refugee. Some thought Mahdi would have more empathy for migrants, as Ellen Desmet. She's a migration law expert at Ghent University.
I think especially in the beginning, also civil society organizations were quite hopeful. And now already with a few months gone, and it's a sense the Secretary of State has taken that he does not want to enter in negotiations, as he considers it blackmail in his own terms.
6 days after the protest started, Mahdi tweeted that the migrants' demands and the occupation of the church was nothing more than blackmail. Desmet says undocumented migrants have very few rights in Belgium. They cannot work legally, and those that do are often exploited. Now with the COVID crisis, even black market work has dried up, she says. The migrants do have reason to hope that the protest might succeed. There were large-scale demonstrations in the Beganage church in 2000 and 2009, and the government did grant some temporary residency permits as a result. But those protests also ended with several of the migrants on hunger strike. And this worries Karen Nessens from the Catholic charity.
Yes, there's talks about it. I hope it won't happen again. They're already putting themselves in danger with coronavirus. I really hope it won't happen, but I feel and see the desperation they have.
Nessens says Sami Mahdi, the migration secretary, has agreed to meet with the protesters, but he's already warned that he's against granting them all legal status. I asked 19-year-old Nada what the migrants will do if Mahdi refuses to meet their demands.
He has to change his mind, because we have to go to the university. The babies, they have to grow up. I see his father, he was an immigrant too. He has to change his mind.
4 weeks into the protest, and a number of migrants in the church have become ill. 3 have been taken to hospital. Karen Nesson says many are suffering psychologically too. Mohammed Amin, the teenager staying in the church, says his greatest fear is being deported back to Morocco, where his abusive father lives.
It's not just about my life, it's about my mother's life too, since my father was hitting my mother. And so he could do something that is even worse. He can imprison her in a house or something like that. My mother could suicide and I will be on my own.
Amin says he doesn't know how long they'll stay at the Beganaj church. It could be weeks or it could be months. After all, he says, what other choice do we have? For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Award season is upon us. Last night at the Golden Globes, director Chloe Zhao had a big moment in the spotlight.
Oh my God. Okay.
That's Zhao's reaction to winning the Golden Globe for Best Director for the film Nomadland. The 38-year-old is only the second woman ever to win a Golden Globe for Best Director and the first woman of Asian descent to win that category. Zhao was born in Beijing. Nomadland is the story of a woman in her 60s who loses everything in the Great Recession of 2008 and sets off wandering through the American West in a van. Zhao's acceptance speech included a quote from one of the real-life nomads featured in the film.
Compassion is the breakdown of all the barriers between us. A heart-to-heart bonding. Your pain is my pain. It's mingled and shared between us.
Congrats to Chloe Zhao for breaking through barriers. Also, a hat tip to Jason Sudeikis, awarded for playing the title character in the series Ted Lasso, a favorite here in a newsroom filled with Brits and Americans, tea drinkers, and coffee addicts. Lasso is an American football coach who relocates to England as a soccer coach.
I always figured that tea was just going to taste like hot brown water. And you know what? I was right. Yeah, it's horrible. No, thank you.
Welcome to England.
Which reminds me, it's time for a cuppa. We have a lot of work to do, so I feel ready to go. Motivating words today from the new head of the World Trade Organization. The arrival of Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala ends a six-month leadership void at the WTO. The international body based in Geneva governs trade rules between countries. Okonjo-Iweala's candidacy had been held up by the Trump White House. On her first day, she's making history as the first woman and first African to serve as WTO Director General.
I absolutely do feel an additional burden. I can't lie about that. Being the first woman and the first African means that one really has to perform.
That was Okonjo-Iweala last month. She's a Harvard grad, an economist, and dual citizen of the U.S. and Nigeria, with a 30-year career in international development, including time as managing director at the World Bank. The Biden administration announced its strong support for Okonjo-Iweala. Still, there was controversy. Senior African leaders at the United Nations recently complained about what they called racist and sexist media coverage of her appointment. For her part, Okonjo-Iweala has said that she remains focused on making the changes needed at the WTO.
It's clear to me that deep and wide-ranging reforms are needed. And as I said before, it cannot be business as usual at the WTO.
In her first speech as head of the WTO today, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala reiterated that point. She said she can only deliver results if members accept that we can do things differently. The most urgent priorities, she said, are to address the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change. On that crucial issue of climate change, we turn to Rachel Kite. She's a climate diplomacy expert and dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. She's worked closely with Okonjo-Iweala and joins me now. Rachel, do you think the World Trade Organization is a good policy tool or organization for dealing with climate change?
I think it's a necessary policy tool. None of the multilateral organizations that were established over the last decades are fit for purpose unless they evolve to deal with the present challenges and future challenges of the global economy. It's not really a question of whether it's the right one or the not. It's the one that we have, and it has to evolve in order to understand the role that trade can play in decarbonizing our economies.
What are the roles you think the WTO could play in climate policy under Okonjo-Iweala?
The WTO has a long history of dealing with the environmental impacts of trade regimes. And it's sort of waxed and waned under the sort of different evolving politics of the trade regime. We're now at a point where we're kind of running out of time. The science is showing us that we need to aggressively cut emissions this decade. So while countries are committing to being zero net carbon by 2050, half of the emissions that we need to reduce need to be reduced this decade. And so the World Trade Organization needs to be sort of resuscitating a global trading conversation and process with decarbonization at its heart. And that that will mean conversations around intellectual property. It means conversations around protecting the trade between the green technologies that developing countries need to have access to and need to have access to now, as well as carbon border adjustments. So there's all kinds of different components of the trade regime which become fundamentally important to this race to zero if the WTO is able to organize itself to that effect.
A lot of the coverage of Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala has focused on the firsts with her arrival at the WTO, first woman, first African to lead it. What does it actually mean for the work, though, that she's now taking on, especially as her eye is on trade and climate?
Well, you know, they always talk about the glass ceiling, right? And Ngozi's broken through that again. But there's also a phenomenon of a glass cliff, which is when a job is impossible, then you give it to a woman. And if it's really impossible, give it to an African woman. So I think that she is comfortable with really onerous and, you know, complex and some would say impossible jobs. We have an enormous challenge ahead of us to manage our global economy going forward so that it meets people's basic needs and it is decarbonized. We've never had to do this before in human history. We are well off track at the moment. And so we need every part of the sort of teetering multilateral system that was built more than 75 years ago, the United Nations, the WTO, the Bretton Woods institutions, the bank and the fund. We need every single piece of that puzzle to be coming together. And I think Ngozi is able to stand back and look at that. And she's also able to put herself in the shoes of the village woman in the market in Nigeria and know what trade means to that person's life aspirations.
I mean, it seems a key part of her CV in this context is that she's someone who really knows about climate change. How do you think she could potentially transform the WTO?
So Ngozi's come to climate change from a development perspective and from a finance perspective. She understands the justice issues related into climate, which I think is very important for somebody who's sitting at the top of the trade regime. Trade has to work for the overall objectives of the economy. Trade has to work so that countries can prosper and meet the needs of their small business owners. Trade has to work so that we can actually remove carbon from our energy systems and from our management of forests and nature. So I think that she's not coming at climate from the perspective of simply looking at how we reduce emissions. She's looking at how those emissions are absolutely embedded in our economic systems. And I think that's exactly the kind of perspective you need at the head of the WTO at this point in our history.
Rachel Kite is the Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, speaking with us about Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, the former Nigerian finance minister and now new head of the World Trade Organization. Rachel, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on the show, there are many ways the Biden administration is trying to undo policies set by the Trump White House. One example, how the U.S. should now deal with the International Criminal Court, a group that's investigating possible U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan.
I don't need the Biden administration to love the fact that U.S. actors are being investigated. But what I do want to see is my government not obstructing justice.
That's coming up tomorrow. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.